Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, my name is Stuart Miles, and welcome to the Pocketlem Podcast. This week, things have really ramped up in terms of product launches, with both Apple and Sony PlayStation dominating the headlines. Apple, at the start of the week with its September Time Flies event, saw the launch of the latest Apple Watch and new iPad Air, and Sony confirming the price, launch date, and launch games for its next generation console, the PlayStation 5. Pocketlem's Rick Henderson joins us in a bit to tell us all about Sony PlayStation, while Dan Grabham pops in later to talk about all things Apple. And sandwiched in between that, I've been talking to Ethan Kaplan, the general manager for digital at Fender, about how you get people to learn musical instruments online. But first, Rick, tell us more about the PlayStation 5.
Well, finally, we finally found out release date and prices. Woohoo!
Yes.
Yeah, and that was essentially what I think most fans were looking out for.
And so, just to recap, so those that missed the announcement itself, what is the price? So I feel like I'm on Price is Right, come on down. What is the price of the PlayStation 5?
Well, of course, there are two separate versions, and the standard PlayStation 5 comes in at £449, $499 in the US. So that's pretty much the most you'll have to pay for a PlayStation 5. The PlayStation 5 All Digital Edition, is £359, $399, which isn't bad, actually. That's quite a good way of getting into the next generation at a cheaper price.
Now, are they what we were expecting? I mean, I know we were always thinking that PlayStation and Sony was going to be punchy. That's still quite expensive, but how does that compare against the Xbox, and has the price changed because of that, do you think?
PlayStation says that it didn't reduce its prices after it had already heard Xbox announce its. It essentially says that it had those prices in mind all the time. I'm not entirely sure I believe that. However, when you actually compare them, the new PlayStation 5 is exactly the same price as the Xbox Series X, which will be some humdigger of a battle. The digital edition is actually £110 in the UK, $100 in the US, more expensive than the Xbox Series S. But what is really important to note is that the PS5 digital edition is actually exactly the same tech specs as the standard PlayStation 5, the only difference being that it doesn't come with a 4K Blu-ray player. The actual Xbox Series S is much lower specification. So essentially, while it's a lot lower price, you are getting much lower tech.
Yeah, because the PlayStation 5 digital hasn't been sort of hampered. They haven't made that a less powerful version, have they, to get that price. All they've done is just said, well, you don't get the disc drive. You have to download all your games.
Absolutely. It's exactly that. It's the disc drive. And I suspect as well that the disc drive doesn't make that disparity in pricing, that they've actually dropped it lower than we probably originally expected, because a disc drive isn't a hugely expensive piece of hardware. But what I actually think is they're banking on making that money back on digital sales. Because, of course, the PlayStation 5 Digital Edition, you won't be able to buy a game from, say, Amazon or Game or Best Buy. You'll have to buy them through the PlayStation Store itself. So at the end of the day, PlayStation will make more money per sale of a game that way than they will on a disc version of a game that you buy elsewhere. Therefore, they can actually make a discless version less expensive.
I suppose in the same way that when you buy and Sony will hate me for saying this, but when you buy a printer, it's incredibly cheap, and then you come to refill the ink and you realize that actually it's more than the printer cost in the first place.
Exactly that. And the early indications we've seen is that PlayStation 5 games will cost you around £70 a pop.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot.
I remember it used to be like 35 quid. Now it's suddenly 70 quid. That's quite a... I mean, that's probably a long time ago since it was £35, but that seems like a quite a punchy price. Do you think gamers will be happy to pay for that much?
It's interesting. I mean, we've seen actually in recent times that even on PlayStation 4 and Xbox One, that gamers are willing to pay for extra content. For example, the most popular version of FIFA that they sell every year is not the basic standard version, but a sort of like an Ultimate Team version, where you get some of the Ultimate Team cards thrown in and a few exclusive extras, but you're actually paying between £79 and £100 for it. And they're very popular nowadays, but we are talking about the standard versions of games. The other funny disparity I've seen recently, certainly in the last few days, is the price of PlayStation 5 games in comparison to Xbox Series X equivalents. Now, even on a very, very simple straw poll, all you have to do is go onto Amazon and check between the PlayStation 5 copy of a game and an Xbox Series X game. And there's a good reason why. There's a roughly $5, £5 price difference. PS5 is more expensive. And the reason I believe is because the Xbox Series X version is also the Xbox One version. It's the same disc. It's exactly the same game. When you plug it in, it will then download the Xbox Series X extras, but they're selling the same game. Work across them all. PlayStation 5 games are not the same as PS4 games. You can't just do it that way.
Now, before we start worrying about, so you've bought the console, you've got the you've paid a little bit more for the games because you bought the games. Is there anything else that you're going to have to bear in mind when you invest in this thing? Do you have to get more controllers, for example?
Yes, this is the other thing, is that PlayStation 5, unlike the Xbox Series X, and we're not putting it down at all, it looks like a fantastic machine. Let's just put it out there, especially the games that are coming up. But the actual, one of the other sort of caveats is that accessories aren't very transferable. Some headsets will be. Some manufacturers will be able to push their USB accessories across platforms, but PlayStation 5 games cannot be played, for example, with a PlayStation 4 controller.
So you're not going to be able to just say, "Oh, I've got four controllers already. I've received those."
Exactly. So you will have to buy the DualSense controller to a second one if you want to play multiplayer games at home. So I think they're around £70.
I was about to say another £70.
Yeah, exactly. It's very expensive. Say you're a parent and your kids said, I want a PlayStation 5. I don't want the Xbox Series S. I want a PlayStation 5 this Christmas. It could become quite an expensive pursuit. But it is very early days. You're talking about early adoption here.
And finally, I know there was a big, obviously, it wasn't just, they didn't just stand up on stage and say, the price is this and it's coming out when. We haven't talked about the price, when it's coming out, actually, have we? So let's quickly talk about that. But then can you also tell us, they told us some game stuff as well. Is there excitements there?
Absolutely. Well, the console actually comes out on the 12th of November in the US, Canada, and some select countries, Japan as well, Sony's own homeland. And the rest of the world get it on the 19th of November. That's essentially, it's exactly a week later. And it's also, the US launch date is 2 days after the Xbox. So it's quite an interesting couple of weeks, though.
Yeah, that'd be, yeah.
And also, then there's Black Friday straight afterwards.
Nice.
So it's quite
to have no money come December 1st.
It's quite a crazy little time. But that's, that's all good. Pre-orders, though, while Xbox still isn't up for pre-order quite yet, PlayStation 5 went pre-order that minute almost. It was it's already available on pre-order. So that's quite extraordinary. The other thing that they obviously did during their showcase event were the games. And this is where many observers are looking at the PlayStation 5 as possibly at launch topping the Xbox Series X, because it has a really good lineup of games. And they announced quite a few on that showcase. So one of which, a particular fave, and this is coming to all consoles, to be absolutely fair, is Hogwarts Legacy.
Mm.
That was the one that probably excited me the most. It's the long-awaited Harry Potter RPG, which means that you are a student, you start out as a character you've created as a student, and you go to Hogwarts. It's actually based in the 1800s, so you don't actually get to meet Harry Potter at all.
Also, that's even before like the Fantastical Beasts as well.
Exactly. So. And that's very clever because I think they're actually going to try and tie it in with the full story. So you'll see kind of how the evil ones all became the evil ones, et cetera, et cetera. It looks really good. It's being developed by Avalanche as well, who develops the Mad Max game.
Wow.
Kind of a...
one extreme to the other.
Yeah, exactly. So, but that looks excellent. And the other big exclusive, and I'd say that in inverted commas, was Final Fantasy 16. Now, obviously, that's a massive deal for any Final Fantasy fans. But I say exclusive in inverted commas because it turns out it's probably only a year's exclusive to console and only 6 month exclusive because there will be a PC version as well.
And so either of those two games available at launch?
No.
What are you going to be playing on launch day? Because I know you probably already pre-ordered one, haven't you?
I have.
What's the first game you're going to be looking forward on launch day to get and play?
There were two. There are two really good launch games coming out. There's Demon's Souls, the latest in the Demon's Souls saga. That looks particularly good, really hard, and it is going to be a launch game, even though they never actually set a release date on the showcase. The other one is Miles Morales, the Spider-Man game. Now, it's only a downloadable content, really. You can buy it as a separate game, and what happens is you get the original Marvel Spider-Man, that they released a little while ago for PS4, but it looks absolutely stunning. This time you get to play Miles Morales as Spider-Man, who is the one that took over from Peter Parker. And it is brilliant. It looks absolutely brilliant. They did quite an extended demo of it during the showcase event. And this is something else I've noticed about ray tracing and next generation games. The best thing in all of them is puddles. That's water effects are superb because obviously it does really realistic sort of reflections and lighting, and puddles look brilliant. And that was a common trend, I think, in every game I saw. There was really nice puddles. So there you go. That's next generation for you. £400 for a puddle.
Still to come, Dan and I talk about the new Apple Watch Series 6.
You know, being overnight with the watch, and then I've got to 10 a.m. the next morning, which seems that key time, and then I need to charge it, but I might not be at my desk or whatever. So that's it. That can be a bit of a problem.
If you wanted to learn a musical instrument, how would you go about doing it? Buy a guitar, head over to YouTube perhaps, maybe even be as bold as to get it some lessons. According to research, what normally happens is that after the first couple of weeks, the instrument soon starts to gather dust and ends up in a cupboard. That's a big problem for brands like Fender, because if you don't keep playing, you're unlikely to want to buy another one. I recently talked to Ethan Kaplan, the general manager for digital at Fender, who is fully aware of the problem and believes Fender has a solution. I started by asking him how his role fits into a company that is seen by many as being very analog.
I came in about 5 years ago, actually, to bring the company into the digital realm. Fender's 75 years old, obviously. And essentially what Fender does is it makes tools for musicians. It makes tools for musicians to create music, guitars, amplifiers, mm-hmm. basses, etc. But people make music in all different forms, and people need to learn how to make music and do that in different forms. And so Fender Digital started really to bridge the gaps between the times when people are holding a guitar and playing a guitar and learning it, and give them the tools and encouragement needed to continue playing. Our biggest issue was abandonment rate. 90% of people that start playing guitar quit within the first 3 months, if not the first like 30, 60 days. So a lot of what we've done is try to make that first 6 months, first year, now first 2-3 years, really fun and encouraging and educational for anybody picking up the instrument.
And how do you go about doing that? How do you entice more people to carry on playing? Because it was a question I mentioned to a friend that I was interviewing, and he said the first thing when he learned how to play guitar is that it's very easy just to leave it in the cupboard and not come back to it.
I mean, the first thing we tackled was a guitar is actually hard to tune. And if you don't tune a guitar, it sounds pretty bad if you start playing it. So we made a guitar tuner that taught you how to tune. You take it for granted that people would know how, but it was actually all the guitar tuners we could find, both physical ones and digital ones, didn't actually teach you how to use them. So that was the first step. And then the second step was Fender Play. which is a video-based music instruction and guitar instruction system. But it goes, it takes you from just holding the instrument for the first time up through basically advanced beginner competency. But we're always adding content, always adding songs, and it really teaches you how to play guitar using songs that you actually know and songs that you've heard, rather than kind of sounds alike or old rock songs from the 60s that you may have never heard before.
And how's the popularity of Fender Play? Do people, because obviously you could go to YouTube, you could go, you know, buy a music book or what have you. How do people engage in it and take it from there?
Fender Play's been really popular. We did a program during the whole first 3 months of lockdown, basically, to give it away for 3 months. And it grew up to almost 1 million people in there. It's proven really successful, and the retention into the product is way better than we were seeing the retention into the instrument. We're getting more people through that first year, more people through that first 6 months. And while there are video-based instruction programs on YouTube, it's all disjointed. It doesn't have a through line, and it's just video. Fender Play is video plus a lot of other stuff within the product that help you learn how to play. So it's very specific video for learning how to play. But we've seen really great success in it for the last 3 years.
And a lot of people, certainly big companies like Apple and the like, are moving towards a more of a subscription service to sort of try and work out how to keep a repetitive, you know, that customer who's bought their product to come back in. Have you taken inspiration from the way that the big tech companies are doing it and added it here? Or do you see, you know, the subscription service being a big part of Fender almost replacing the need to, you know, to sell guitars?
It's the subscription business we have with Fender Play is very additive to the guitar business. A subscription, especially if you subscribe for a year, really is a focused intent on learning, and it really commits yourself to learning something. In-person guitar lessons are mostly month to month, not with a degree of commitment. So it's easy to quit. With the 1 year subscription to Fender Play, we give you 10% off of Fender gear all year in countries that we support that. And that's really a reward for the commitment. Running a subscription business is very different than selling physical products. But because of the way that media has moved, Apple, Netflix, Google, everybody, it's become more and more popular. But I think subscription's kind of I don't know. It's like a mental barrier of commitment for people. And once they subscribe to something, there's almost a need to use it. And that's really helped us. And it's helped us shape how the product works as well.
And can you give us an example of how it's shaped the product?
Yeah, we know that those first 3 days after signing up are really critical. They're critical for people to kind of sit down and try it. If we can get them through the first 3 days, we can usually get them through the first 14. And we have a trial window that's either 7 or 14 days. And if we can get them through 14, then they're kind of off to the races. And a lot of how we communicate to people, how we structure the onboarding, what we do with things like our Fender Play Live that we do every Wednesday, or our office hours that we do in our Facebook community, all those are around getting people over those initial barriers during that first really critical, you know, 3 to 14 day period. Once they're there, you know, we've gotten people through the holding guitar, my fingers hurt, playing something recognizable. And then we have a lot of this other stuff around the product, the community, the Fender Play Lives, the office hours on Instagram that really encourage people and get people wanting to learn.
Now, one of the things that you could argue is, have you, by having this new type of player, you know, onboarding and starting to use the Fender products, has that changed the way that you're making the guitars? Has it had a response that way?
Yeah, the guitar is an interesting instrument. It's really hard to use. It's a very difficult user interface if you're coming from like my digital product standpoint. It's 6 strings, wood, metal. It's hard to hold sometimes. It's hard to get used to. And so when we started putting the lessons together, a lot of the thinking was, what's the best way to onboard people into a guitar? And a lot of people would start on acoustic, but it was actually electric's the easier one to play. Right. So it shaped a lot of how we put together. We have these things called Squire packs, Squire is our entry level guitars, but they're really amazing. And they, you know, they have, they're just as good as our Fender products. And we have the electric versions and the acoustic versions of those. And those really work alongside Fender Play. And we've adjusted our product roadmap and our product cadence even to suit what we've discovered about beginner guitarists as we've done these projects.
And can you give an example of how that's changed?
We launched some new Squire Minis that are different body shapes than the Stratocaster. We launched a Squire Mini Bass and a Squire Mini Jazzmaster. We're getting a lot more young players and a lot more diverse players coming in that are looking at different form factors and different scales of the guitars, but want something unique still and not something that looks like everybody else's. So it's really pushed us into thinking more broadly about who the new player is going to be and making sure that our products that we sell, the songs that we have in Fender Play, and the way we talk about the product reflect the diversity of the people learning how to play the instrument.
And where does this go? Where do you just see more and more video tutorials in attempt to play? What's the plans for the future?
We continue to add content to Fender Play. We have a pretty deep roadmap of new content, new songs. We just added like Billie Eilish songs. And we continue to look at what's trending on the music charts and even TikTok and things like that. And then seeing if we can get those into Fender Play, because you want the songs that people learn to be reflective of the stuff that they're listening to in the moment. We're also continuing to add features to the product, things that will help you become a more competent player. We're working on some of that stuff in the roadmap right now. We just launched Collections, which is a way of getting kind of off a curriculum path into more deep dives into things like soloing and different techniques. And we'll always adjust to technology. Everybody's always releasing new phones, new ways of doing things, and we will always adjust to that.
And do you think obviously the pandemic this year has forced us to, you know, kids are learning from home and we're forced to, you know, not really go anywhere and see people. Do you feel that this is the way that we're going to be learning things in the future? Or do you think it's a blip and we'll kind of go back to trying to say, well, actually, I'd like a music teacher and someone to come around and actually teach me?
I have two children that just started homeschool this morning or last week, but they're just kicked off their school day. And so I'm living it day to day as, you know, they're home and I'm home and my wife's home and we're all kind of stuck at home. You hope that things are going to return to normal. I don't think it's going to return to what we considered normal before, with or without whatever happens with the COVID-19 virus. I think that people are learning that there's different ways of doing things and different ways of adjusting to doing things. And that I think includes how to learn instruments and how to learn languages and how to learn computer programming and all of those things. People have been thrown headfirst into distance learning, video-based instruction, online instruction, and it's been effective. We've gotten a very different category and different classes and different types of people entering the guitar space. I think 18% of our new users are between the age of 18 and 24, and 70% now under the age of 45, and we've never seen that before. So while I hope for my own sake, my kids can return to school soon and that we can return to some degree of normalcy, I think we've also learned that some of the ways they learn now, very concentrated learning online and self-paced curriculums, and kind of learn where you want, that's here to stay, and that's great. I think Fender Play as an online learning product will complement and can complement in-person learning. There's always something to get out of sitting with somebody and playing with them. At the same time, we'll continue to broaden our instruction and broaden our curriculum and encourage people to keep playing, because it's not, no one predicted that in March, no one would be able to see each other for 7 months. And so we want to make sure that whatever happens, if in-person learning becomes more popular again, if it becomes safer, whatever happens in the future, that we still have this product that's there to fill the gaps too.
Apple's September event is normally reserved for the launch of the company's iPhones, but this year, yeah, guess what? It's 2020. Has disrupted the supply chains, with the Apple iPhone launch being pushed back to October. All things changed. But that hasn't stopped Apple launching two new Apple Watches and two new iPads, as well as a new subscription service called Fitness Plus and the Apple One bundle that pulls everything together further. Still, guess what? I've been wearing the new Apple Watch. Yes, I've got it on my wrist right now, talking to you. Well, Dan, thanks for joining us. And Dan's been following the announcements. Now, I know you've been using the Watch OS 7 beta, and you've actually been sleeping with your phone, haven't you? So we thought it'd be nice to be basically throw it around and discuss everything with the new Apple Watch and whether we'll be sleeping with our Apple Watches from now on. So, Dan, are you still sleeping with it?
Well, yes, most of the time. But the problem is that I was habitually charging it at night. So there's a behavioural shift for all Apple Watch users in that you now need to charge it in the day. And that's, you know, that's not always worked out for me, because sometimes I've found that if I've, you know, been overnight with the watch and then I've got to 10 a.m. the next morning, which seems that key time, and then I need to charge it, but I might not be at my desk or whatever. So that can be a bit of a problem. But the sleep tracking itself is actually really good. It you know, it's set and forget. The setup process is a bit fiddly in terms of you need to specify bedtimes, a sleep target.
What is your bedtime, Dan?
11. I've got it set to.
Yeah, there you go. Nice.
But it informs me that I've not met my sleep target because of my 3-year-old at any point. So so there's that. But yeah, the setup process is a bit finicky, because you need to set up the wind down time and it integrates with your alarm clock and everything. So there's actually quite a few options to choose from. And it puts your watch into a do not disturb mode automatically and that kind of thing. But it actually works really well. I mean, I don't know how you've obviously, you haven't slept with the Apple Watch Series 6 yet, but how have you found the newer features?
This feels such a wrong conversation. Have you slept with your gadget yet? No, we're recording this on Thursday evening. The podcast goes out on Friday. So I got the Apple Watch this morning. So I put it on, downloaded, you know, set it up, and I've been wearing it kind of pretty much sat on my desk. So I haven't really gone out as far that much with it. The display went off. I mean, there's a couple of new things from a technology point of view that I've kind of noticed straight away. There's obviously a slightly faster processor. Flicking around the menus and the interface, it feels slightly faster, but it's really early days to determine whether it is or not. It's always like the Series 5. It's got an always-on display. They've made the display brighter. It's now 500 nits rather than 300 nits. For most people, that won't mean a thing. We normally talk about nits when it comes to TV displays and phones and things like that. Apple says it's 2.5 times brighter, which means that you should be able to see it in daylight. Now, I stood outside in the sun. It's quite a sunny day today. And yeah, it was clearer, which is great. They've also changed some of the watch faces. They're not as black and white, as I call it. Now, if you've used a Series 5 watch, you'll notice that when the screen is trying to save power, kind of dulls everything down. And normally, if you've got a colorful watch face, then it inverts. So if it's a block like pink number, it will become an outline pink number, and then the fill will go black to try and save power.
Yeah, because I found that really annoying with the Series 5, actually. They quite kind of, I'm sort of not necessarily looking at it directly, but the screen goes dull, and I'm then trying to sort of wiggle my wrist to wake
up. So there's two things that I've noticed already that I'm doing with this. Firstly, because I'm a narcissist, clearly I've got an emoji of me looking back at me at the moment. I set that up at the beginning thinking this would be fun for the photos, and then I haven't managed to have time to swipe off that yet. So every time I look at my watch, it's an emoji of me going, "Hi, how are you?" kind of thing, which is a bit weird. Secondly, what they've done, so that doesn't obviously invert, so I don't become an outline. It just stays and it goes a bit duller, so that's fine. They've changed Watch OS 7 that when it is, for these watches, when the screen is off, i.e. dulled out or however you want to call it, you can now interact with the complications. They're the bits on the watch, where before, and I used to find this a real problem, is it'd be dull. You'd think it was clear enough to tap on. You'd tap on it and then nothing would happen, because that would be you waking the screen, and then you'd tap again to then get through it. Now all you have to do is just tap the complication and off you go.
That's pretty cool.
That's a big thing I've noticed even in the first couple of hours of using it. there's lots of things that the two big things that from a sensor's point of view is you've now got an altimeter, which should make a huge difference to fitness apps, because it will be able to tell me the actual height I am. So that'd be quite cool. So I'm interested to see whether that will make a difference in my running and things like that. So I can actually determine when I've climbed a hill or what have you. Still to explore that feature. And the new sensor is blood oxygen monitoring, which is available on quite a few other sort of smartwatches from Garmin and things like that. This is the idea. There's some red lights that allow it to take a picture of your blood or how much oxygen's in your blood and then relay it back. I press the button, I've got 100%. Woo! Congratulations to me. What that means, I have no idea. I then did it an hour later and I only had 98%. I was disappointed. Oh. So, but you know, talking to people that have been using these on other devices, if you're healthy, you get between 95 and 100%. And talking to Apple, they kind of tell me that this is not a medical thing. They didn't have to, like the ECG where they had to go and get medical approval for this. It's not that, but so we're still trying to work out where that will fit in the world over the coming months, I suppose.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like it's the most useful update this time around. I mean, do you think it's sort of a bit more iterative than we've seen before?
I think the Apple Watch seems to be, it's really hard, right? If you're going to buy a brand, it feels to me it's about bringing in new people. And therefore, it's a refinement designed to appeal to those new users who have not got an Apple Watch yet. And there's still lots of Apple users out there that haven't got an Apple Watch yet, or we've got in very early and haven't upgraded for a while, you know, to say, hey, look, this is all shiny and exciting, rather than teasing those to have already bought a 4 or 5 to upgrade. So it's with the phones and Apple phones, you always kind of, you've got those big group of people that will just go out every year and go, I want a new one. And then after a while, it was, well, I'm going to skip this one, like the S's, wasn't it? You'd skip the S's and you'd get the next one. And it feels like we're starting to get into that scenario with the watch, in that it's an amazing, don't know two doubts about it, it is an amazing smartwatch, right? It does everything that you'd expect it to do. And from the other watches I've tested, you know, just the way that they do it and make it work and all the other stuff, it's brilliant. But if you were a Series 5 user, and I would have told you probably the same last year as well, is that there's no reason for you to upgrade. And so I think that's where we're going to start getting with the watch, is that they've created this product that is fantastic. But it's not that there isn't the huge technological leaps each year that we used to see with the early days of mobile phones, where, you know, be like, oh my God, I've got to go and get this new thing because it's so much better.
One of the interesting things this time around as well is we've now got three Apple watches, haven't we? We've got the old Series 3 and the Series 6, which you've got there. And we've also got the Watch SE, which sort of sits in between. We were expecting the Watch SE to probably replace the Series 3, but obviously they couldn't get it down to the appropriate price point. And the SE is sort of a cut down Series 5, isn't it, slightly? So how do you think that's all going to fit together?
Well, Series 3 is clearly, to my belief, is Series 3 is there to hit a price point of sub £200. It's for those people that just want something a little bit better than a Fitbit, but don't really want to start spending big money, so to speak. And I think it's great. It's disappointing that because it hasn't got a cellular version of the Series 3, that it doesn't fit with this new thing called Family Setup, which Apple have launched as well, which is allowing either kids or older people that don't necessarily have access to an iPhone to be able to use a watch all controlled by, you know, effectively the parents or the carer's account. You can have up to 5 in a family, so if you really want to go crazy with that, and it's all controlled by, you know, the master iPhone user, so to speak, which, and I think from a kid's perspective, you think of the way that if you use an iPhone, your kids use iPhone, whether you control it via screen time and you can see what they do and where they are and contacts and all the other stuff, it's not called screen time for watch, but it's effectively the same kind of thing. I do think the popular one for many, though, is going to be this SE. It does a lot of the things that you would want. It, you know, there are some restrictions there. It doesn't necessarily have all the same functionalities, but, you know, for most people, for that initial, if you don't want cellular, and it's, I think it's $279, £279 around about that marker. It's a brilliant entry level into the Apple experience, and will give you access to a Fitness Plus and all those things when that launches. But, you know, for most people, I think that's probably the one to go for. And it, almost to the point where I'm surprised they didn't call the Apple Watch 6, you know, Series 6 Apple Watch Pro, and, you know, to fit in with the iPhone Pro and the iPad Pro and all those kind of things, and the, you know, the regular SE one that they're now launching, just calling it Apple Watch. So
yeah, that's a good point, actually, because they seem to be introducing Pro into more product lines. We saw it with AirPods as well, obviously. I guess as a final point, do you think that Series 6 is going to sell the most, or do you think SE is actually going to, because of its more appealing price point, is going to be the big seller?
Yeah, I think the SE is probably going to be the one that you'll find under most Christmas trees this year. You know, it's that typical thing. You know, I'm currently wearing the graphite stainless steel one. It's a very nice looking watch. I know you've had stainless steel on your watches in the past, Dan.
Yes, I have.
It gives you that extra sort of luxury element to it. But that said, you know, the Series 5 I've been wearing was a aluminium one, and it's just as great. So I think the SE one is the one that most people will end up wanting to buy.
Well, that's it for this week's show. Thanks for listening. Until next time, pip pip.